Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, everybody, to this new episode of Your Money Today. And for the first time in a while, again, I'm going to do my own shtick here. Well, at least somewhat. You're going to find out in a minute one key way that that's not true this week when I commend something to you that you need to listen to as much or more than me. But here, nevertheless, we are not doing everybody else's podcasts in the last week or two, as I've been doing a lot of traveling. So we're going to wrap up a lot of things right here ourselves. My recent trip to New York and what we learned there. A couple of very important macro developments. We're going to talk about the bond markets of the world. We're going to talk about the big, beautiful bill that now has to go to the Senate and what the market implications of that are going to be. Another Trump about face on tariffs, at least for the moment, that will cheer up Wall Street in the week ahead. I'm recording this in the evening on Memorial Day, May the 26th. I hope you've all had a great long weekend here in the U.S. And of course, last week, you folks up in Canada had your turn. But let's get right to it. First off, one very brief commercial message slash reminder. As you probably already know, if you're on my mailing list or have seen some other advertisements, a week from today, starting June the 2nd, next Monday, I will be leading off a week-long investor boot camp put on by the Equity Explorers. That's kind of an adjunct of investorideas.com, one of the websites that I'm occasionally a guest of, and really love these people. And anyway, it's going to be a week-long, really roll-up-your-sleeves type of thing that's going to get into natural resources. Generally, it'll be some nuances and a few exceptions to specific mining-related themes. We'll talk about energy and so forth. But anyway, yours truly will, again, kick things off on Monday. There will be other guests during the week. I've got a link to the information about this boot camp where you can register for free. Make sure you do that, whether you can make the live sessions or not, because that will get you first in line for the recordings and some other goodies that go along. Generally speaking, and I think that the final schedule is being solidified right now, these will start, they're not a full day thing, these will start after the close of financial markets. Shortly thereafter, you'll get the specific time when you sign up. And my presentation next Monday is going to be an update on the new FANGs theme, which I'll be talking about a little bit more where resources are concerned in just a minute. The new FANGs, of course, is a theme that started to gain some traction a few years ago, kind of went on hiatus for a while, but is roaring back now with all of the things going on in the world with tariffs, with embargoes over rare earths, over uranium, energy, and a whole host of things. This is very, very important stuff, and it's going to kind of set the table for the balance of the week after that, where the other experts who will be following me will be discussing specific areas. I'm going to kind of give an umbrella view of all of the different themes in the new FANGs, which are pretty much all different forms of energy, resources, etc. Very provocative stuff. I'll talk for no more than about a half hour, maybe not even that. And one of the things these folks are doing to make this a very interactive experience is that after that, we'll have a lot of time for your own questions and whatnot, your own areas of interest and so forth. So please be sure, look at the link attached to the show notes for this episode. Register for the conference. Take part as best as you can. If you can't make it, again, make sure you're registered so you get this afterward. Very, very important stuff, and I'm going to tell you now why. Most of you know, again, that I was in New York for the majority of last week, chiefly at the 10th annual Critical Trends in Mining Finance Conference put on by the New York section of the SME. The SME is pretty much the oldest and largest organization of its kind that follows the nuts and bolts of mining, of extractive industries, and so forth over the years. It has a foundation attached with very, very great people, worthwhile people to be familiar with. I'm going to have a link to the SME's core website also on the show notes for those of you that want to learn more about this organization. I'll be speaking this summer to the Wyoming branch, such as it is, of the SME, specifically on the uranium and nuclear energy industry. And of course, that's going to be one of the sub-themes I cover in the coming boot camp in the New Fangs. The N in the New Fangs stands for nuclear energy. And big deal this last week, as some of you saw, I'm sure, the president signed a series of executive orders that lit a fire underneath the whole space, from small modular reactor makers, uranium miners, and everybody else in between. A great week as it ended up last week for the uranium and nuclear energy space. But anyway, good organization, so I'm delighted to be part of that effort. When I was there, I actually was speaking on two topics. One is I led a panel on uranium and nuclear energy. I'll be talking more about that in the days ahead in a National Investor, and then a special issue that I'll be redoing and putting out shortly on this sector. And secondly, in a recording that I did ahead of time, that has been made available. It wasn't a part of the official in-person program, but part of the other extracurricular activities. And this is what I want to lead off this particular discussion with. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I've mentioned it a few times in a recent past. But folks, I have discussed for a while now that we are already in a World War III over commodities and currencies. In just a minute after this topic, I'm going to talk about the theme, which is woefully misrepresented and misunderstood, of the so-called Great Reset in the world. And that very much involves control over and access to commodities as well. This is not some pie-in-the-sky kind of thing like too many people. Anyway, the topic that I did a quick 11-minute video on that is also going to be linked in the show notes for those of you that haven't seen already and want to see it, discusses specifically President Trump's executive orders from earlier this year, which a lot of people think made everything all well with the world again, where U.S. mining specifically is concerned. He signed executive orders over speeding up permitting and a bunch of things like that. And I'm here to tell you that a very false sense of security has come about because of that. And you need to watch this video. You need to learn more about it. And I tell you that because among the subjects that I spoke with a lot of my colleagues at in New York, and I have to say I was happy to see that a lot of people see things as I do that are in these industries all day long, not just commenting on them part of the time like yours truly does. I was happy to see that they understand that President Trump's executive orders have not cured anything. In fact, from a lot of people, a couple of whom surprised me, there is as much or more skepticism from them as I've expressed over this in the recent past. You're going to find out why, because we are in a place where, and I've said this so many times, it wasn't just in recent decades. T-shirts and Christmas toys, and as we found out during COVID, bandages and supplements and vitamins and some pharmaceuticals and things like that, that we outsourced largely to China, but also to other countries since we didn't want to manufacture them anymore here. The powers behind the scenes, behind the politicians, made more money themselves by outsourcing these industries over the years. But it was extractive industries. And more than that, it was the technology over how to process things. You know, just one quick example for the moment. President Trump has made a big deal out of wanting to get a rare earths deal with Ukraine if a peace ever does break out between Russia and Ukraine. That's a little tenuous right now. He's also discussed a potential deal with the Democratic Republic of the Congo to get raw materials there. And, you know, these sound good, and maybe in some ways are good, but they're largely off point, because our problem in the U.S. is not that we don't have lithium and nickel and cobalt and rare earth elements and things like that. We've got a lot of them, and copper and some other things. What we don't have, and what we have allowed China to basically corner the market on for quite a while now, are the processing capabilities to refine these things and turn them into usable products. That's especially true, of course, with rare earth elements, as many of you know, that are turned into magnets and very high-tech things that go into computers and whatnot. And they control the overwhelming majority of the processing capabilities in the world. And of course, this is part of this ongoing battle between the U.S. and China. I'll be talking about that a lot more in the near term as well. So what I found in New York among a lot of my colleagues who were involved not only in working with and for mining companies, engineering companies, but also in public policy capacities, advocacy, and things like that, is a very sober assessment that we have got a far bigger job ahead of us as a country to get back bit by bit, piece by piece, some of the control over our own destiny. Economics is a huge part of it, like I discuss in my 11-minute video I'm giving you the link of. And everybody, I have to say, and I'm happy to say, I'm not happy about the situation, but I'm glad that this resonated with everybody. Everybody to a person who watched this says, holy cow, you're right. I knew it was bad. I didn't think it was this bad. And yes, we've got to roll up our sleeves. We've got a lot of work to do. And we need to be careful how we behave in the months and years ahead in the world with these various trade deals and things like that, because we are still not at a place, the U.S., where we have the ability to basically meet a lot of our needs when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to mining, to metals, to critical materials, to, again, the processing of those and so forth. So I'm going to talk about this all more in the days ahead, another special issue coming up on energy and commodities. One of the things that I also kind of used my colleagues and others in New York as a sounding board for was the idea that Canada, now that Prime Minister Mark Carney is solidified in his role, and he's not just a caretaker anymore, what he may do to change the lot of Canadians' lives, because of course that country has been even more horribly mismanaged when it comes to resources than what we had under the Biden administration up until recently. But there are some indications that that's going to change significantly. And institutionally and governmental-wise, it's going to be easier to fix things, believe it or not, in Canada than it's going to be in the U.S. for a whole host of reasons I'll be discussing. So I don't want a sound victory yet. I don't want to be, and you'll see a reference to this in the video link, I don't want to be like George Bush on the aircraft carrier on behalf of Canadians saying mission accomplished, because there's a whole lot that still needs to be accomplished. But starting from a place where there's a big desire and I think political impetus in Canada to largely remove the federal government from most permitting and regulatory activities, leave it up to the provinces, if Carney and others follow through with that, and if they finally put the pieces in place to help the energy sector up there, which is horribly underdeveloped, horribly underutilized, Canadians are going to have some years ahead that are really going to be prosperous and really allow that country to shine and to finally benefit from and monetize its role as having proportionally more natural resource wealth than most countries in the world, certainly considerably more than the U.S. and easier in some ways to develop. So this is an evolving story. You're going to want to follow that. Now, shifting gears somewhat, I want to point out that the World War III over commodities, as I've occasionally termed it, and all of the different trade pressures and embargo pressures and economic pressures and so forth to provide ever more resources of pretty much all kinds in the years ahead to a world where demand is not falling, but pretty much rising for everything. This all, in part, needs to be understood against the backdrop of an overall global economy and financial structure and regimen that is changing and is about to change far more dramatically. We've already seen some signs of this in the recent past. In fact, one of the hot topics at a dinner that I was privileged to attend last week toward the end of the conference put on by a very dear friend, Laura Stein. A few of you who follow the resource space in North America know her. She's been an institution for a lot of years, following a lot of companies, promoting the industry and so forth. Likewise, Jay Taylor, an old dear friend for many years, who is one of the existing deans of newsletter writers. He's got just a few years on me when it comes to that. But we were talking about a hot topic in the press last week, of course, of the implosion in the Japanese bond market that we're going to continue to follow in the weeks ahead. It's not likely to get a whole hell of a lot better. But all of those things are elements of a reordering of the world. And there's been all kinds of stuff out there long before President Trump came in for his second term. We hear all kinds of cockamamie things sometimes, you know, cornball predictions over Biden bucks, and we're all going to get a central bank digital currency, and there's going to be a new gold-backed currency, and Trump is going to do thus and so with the gold at Fort Knox. There's crazy, dire predictions. There are outlandish, optimistic predictions that Americans are about to become ridiculously wealthy. In fact, I've seen the same carnival huckster just in the last month predict doom in the next couple weeks, and at the same time in other ads tell you that in the month of May we're going to see the foundation for a new boom and you're going to get rich as an investor. Of course, both of those are going to be the case if you listen to him. So I won't belabor all of that, but I am going to tell you this. Another link that I'm adding to the show notes, which is probably the best and most succinct look that I've seen in one place on what the so-called Great Reset is all about and what's truly going on in the world. When you look at the headlines, you look at the foreign policy headlines, the financial headlines, and everything else. When you understand what it is, at least on a thematic level, that President Trump is trying to do or thinks he's trying to do, all of these things are coalescing in what could be, in the days ahead, and a part cataclysmic when it comes to the markets, upheaval. And again, I'm going to get to the specifics of the Japanese bond market and the treasury market in just a minute. But even underneath all of that, there's been a lot of things that have started to come to a head for a while now, the retreat from globalization, the move toward a multipolar world, and so forth. And again, I have hardly seen a better and succinct and realistic and nonpartisan take on all of this in one place than in a video I watched at the beginning of the weekend. Professor Glenn Dyson, who some of you follow, he's a Norwegian writer and political activist, usually derided as a Russian stooge like so many people are who don't want World War III with Russia, but he's put out some great information and he has great guests on his program. Well, one of the great guests he had on his podcast recently is a fellow named Alex Craner, whose things I've only seen sporadically, but I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to be paying more attention to him. He's a market analyst. He's also an author, used to run a hedge fund. And I'll tell you what, in about 45 or so minutes, the discussion that they had, again, I'm giving you the link with the show notes here, is the best and most foundational understanding you could possibly have for everything going forward. the likely success or failure of Trump's game plan internationally, what it is he's trying to accomplish with his relations with Russia, with Iran, and others, the stresses on the U.S. markets as well as on other markets. And I'll tell you, I really heard some remarkable stuff come especially from Mr. Trainor. You know, he discussed, for example, how, and I alluded to this a few minutes ago when I discussed how, you know, the U.S. specifically has outsourced the production and control thereof of most everything to China chiefly and to others over the years. But Trainor properly puts it on the back of imperialists. There are people who are beneath the scenes of power and the observable levers of power in the U.S. for many decades now, who have used those levers of power to enrich themselves, to conquer the world, to cause far more problems than they've ever solved. And these are the people, the so-called deep state is one of the monikers, of course, used. These are the people whom President Trump, in somewhat of an imperfect way, but at least it's something, is really trying to unseat and keep the U.S. together as part of the whole process. I have to honestly tell you, and those of you who followed me know that I love to wear my own, you know, neutrality, so to speak, where Trump is concerned, on my sleeve. I love to say I don't have either version of TDS. I don't have Trump derangement syndrome, but neither do I have Trump deification syndrome as well. I question everything. I don't care who it is that's in there. But I have to tell you, after listening to what Mr. Trainor had to say, I've got a little bit better myself of an understanding of an appreciation for just how daunting the task is that he faces. I loved it when Trainor referred to a comment early on, and I made a big deal of this at the time, if you remember, those who follow me on social media, where he referred back to a comment that Secretary of State Marco Rubio made about how, you know, we recognize that we're going into a multipolar world. We've got to dial back certain expectations. We have to reinforce our own national sovereignty and our own national priorities. I mean, these are things that are happening whether we like them or not. You might be out there thinking that, well, you think the U.S. should be the world's policeman. You think the U.S. should be bringing democracy and freedom to the world, even at the point of a gun. But one of the things that these guys expertly tied together is that the jig is up. There is no longer the room in the markets for the U.S., actually the imperialists who have used the U.S. markets and political institutions and financial markets and all the rest of it to be able to do that. Things are about to break. They have to change. And the way in which they change is going to dictate, you know, what you need to do as an investor, how we need to look at things as citizens, how we respond to things as a country, etc. But again, without getting any deeper into that right now, I'm going to shut up and move on to the last couple of topics I want to share. But I implore you to watch this discussion between Professor Dyson and Mr. Trainor. And again, I cannot think of better and more foundational information and an understanding of what's going on in the world that you're going to find in one place. I mentioned a lot of these things from time to time myself, but I could not have done this good a job putting this together. I'm not ashamed to say that at all. So make sure you pay attention to this. Now I want to move on. Well, I didn't make a big deal out of the 100-day mark for the Trump administration, but I've got a few observations now that we're along about day 130 or so. And along those lines, too, I'm going to somewhat limit my remarks. I'm adding a couple of links as well to the show notes of a couple of people that I follow on the platform X, formerly known as Twitter. I still always call it Twitter, of course. I just can't break that habit. X sounds, I don't know, whatever. That's another story. But anyway, one of the hot topics in New York when we had dinner and even apart from that was the development in recent days in the Japanese bond market. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I want you to look at these links that I send along, and those of you who are especially interested can roll up your sleeves. But the bottom line, my friends, is this, alluding to comments I just made about how pretty much the jig is up in the world and with markets. The ability to use endless debt the world over, and particularly where the U.S. is concerned, to run endless deficits, to have all of that funny money credit creation disproportionately in the hands of the imperialists who have been running this country for a long time and have largely conquered the world economically or militarily or otherwise, it's drawing to a close. And we remember, you know, the term that we were using a lot last week that you may have heard or read in the past is financial repression. Financial repression got underway in an especially big way in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, where rather than markets and nature taking their what should have been their course and actually having themselves the ability to clean up messes and excesses and bad debts and so forth that existed back then, the powers that be, led by the Federal Reserve, of course, here in the U.S., decided that we're not going to allow people to go bankrupt, at least big people. We're not going to let nature take its course. We're going to paper all of this over. We're going to play extend and pretend, etc. And the little people will lose their houses and businesses and things like that, but we're not going to let the system get hurt and our big friends on Wall Street and everything like that. So instead of having, maybe for a period of time, following the financial crisis, interest rates rise on a lot of different kinds of debt, and maybe for a lot of different types of businesses and people, seeing a situation where new credit was completely unattainable. Okay, everybody went, and I'm speaking generally, of course, everybody went the other direction. And so we had interest rates jammed down, financial repression. Whether you deserved it or not, you got loan extensions, you got zero interest and all this kind of stuff. And so we have in the ensuing 16 or 17 years build up bubbles and imbalances the world over, arguably in a big way far worse than what led to the collapse in 2008, or at least it coalesced in 2008. It was kind of a rolling thing in some areas, especially for real estate. But generally speaking, along the way, different central banks and different currencies took their turns as being, for example, a carry trade currency. More often than not, and this was even taking place before 2008, it was Japan. The value of the yen is a fraction of what it was when Japan's respective financial bubbles peaked way back starting in 1989. And the yen, over the years, has been used as a very liquid currency. The Japanese bond market, largely underpinned by the Japanese central bank itself, has mastered financial repression more than anybody, really, in relative terms, in recent years. And so for a long time, they were able to keep interest rates down to pretty much nothing all across the yield curve. You had yield curve control. But that now doesn't work anymore. And so all of a sudden you have had, and I've shared this on social media for those of you who follow me, and I'm going to, again, give you a few links. So I won't repeat it too much here and take too much more time. But all of a sudden, this is unraveling. And despite the fact that Japan's central bank owns about half of the Japanese bond market itself, when they're holding auctions these days and trying to sell what the Japanese central bank isn't scarfing up, nobody wants it. Because now, after years of this financial repression, inflation, which was absent from Japan rather for 30 years or something like that, is all of a sudden rearing its head. It's now running at even a faster pace, if you believe the numbers, than what is reported even here in the U.S. And in Europe. And the wheels are coming off. And what happens when you have a situation like that, we saw an example of this back in 2008. You have a situation where speculators, hedge funds, institutions, banks, whoever the case may be, who borrowed cheap yen or low-yielding Japanese IOUs, Japanese bonds of some kind, and used those things to affect trades where they thought there was more juice, whether it was invest in commodities or stocks or whatnot in other places in the world. Now, all of a sudden, when especially the Japanese bond market is underwater, people are getting margin calls, they're getting forced into having to liquidate. And they're having to liquidate other things to buy back the Japanese paper and whatnot that they borrowed or hypothecated in the first place to make this happen. You know, you may remember that back in 2008, there had been a period where the U.S. dollar, thanks to Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan prior, had been used as a carry trade currency. It was artificially cheap. Interest rates were lower than they should have been for a while. And that was why when everything collapsed in 2008, the dollar screamed higher. It's because people were selling stuff and having to replace dollars that they had borrowed or leveraged in order to affect these other trades. And so now we're seeing an unwinding of this, arguably, on a global stage with what's going on in Japan. It is reverberating elsewhere. It could well be a part of the reason why we are seeing the Treasury market misbehaving. And of course, President Trump and his Treasury Secretary Bessent have been carping about that. Why aren't interest rates coming down? Well, you know, among other things, you just told us you want to have $2 trillion plus deficits every year for the next 10 years or worse. So no wonder. And again, this goes to show that there's pretty much an end now. We're at the end game of this financial repression. And I'm not telling you that the U.S. is going to default. The U.S. is not going to default on its debt, at least not outright. That's not in the cards. And that's not what Moody's said recently when it downgraded the U.S.'s credit rating on paper. What it did imply, and it probably didn't go far enough in this particular thing, is that what is going to happen in years to come is that, yes, you will be, quote, paid, end quote, but you're going to be paid in ever cheaper dollars because it's going to require much greater money printing on a part of the Fed and monetization of debt by the Fed beyond what we've seen already with the Fed's $7 or $8 trillion balance sheet, wherever it sits today. We're going to see a lot more of that. And so, yeah, you'll get paid down the road, but it's going to be in cheaper dollars. And understandably, that's why the bond market vigilantes and others in the markets right now, despite the fact that headline inflation has fluttered back down a bit in recent months, they want higher yields on long-term government bonds because of that long-term risk of losing purchasing power, especially when you have the government pretty much telling you that yet again, with a new Republican administration, a Republican president that says he's a fiscal conservative, Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate, albeit with slim margins in both places, they're not going to do a damn thing in a big way to change the trajectory of things. We're going to continue to have huge budget deficits, continue to add to the debt. And, you know, as time goes on, we're looking at the prospect of adding in the next decade $20 trillion some odd dollars. And this is just based on what we know right now, let alone things that we don't know. And let alone if we did have a more sizable and broad economic downturn than what may be unfolding right now, which will pretty much guarantee that you've got to have a bigger deficit still because there'll be lower tax receipts and higher payments going out to people who are unemployed, etc. So it's not a pretty picture. And all of this, folks, is why I've been harping incessantly on the president's behavior where it concerns especially the budget and his different priorities and so forth. And I warned, in part with this year's theme here at the National Investor, let's do the math. It's why I've repeatedly discussed the challenges that President Trump and his second term faces, very similar to what happened to Jimmy Carter when he took office in 1977, similarly in some other ways to what Bill Clinton faced in his first term in 1993. when financial pressures and bond market pressures respectively that had already been unleashed and were underway when both of those prior presidents came in, but which affected them directly, so too does President Trump have a situation where his budget negotiating and everything else is being dictated increasingly by these fits that the bond market has thrown, number one. Number two, the broader picture of America's debt simply being at a point where it's at the breaking point. And again, not that we're going to default, not that the U.S. can't raise money, but it's going to be at incrementally higher interest rates. And the markets are not ready for that. The federal budget process is not ready for that. Stock investors are not ready for that. Nobody's ready for the fact that if things don't change where the budget is concerned, we will see higher long-term interest rates still in this cycle beyond what we've seen already, no matter what the economy does, no matter what inflation allegedly does, again, whether you believe the government's own massage numbers or not, and all of that simply because of the gargantuan supply of credit that the U.S. has to service. There are other countries in the world that on paper and statistically have somewhat worse debt to GDP ratios as far as how it affects the economy, but by sheer volume, the U.S. Treasury has for a long time now taken up a disproportionate amount of oxygen in the room, and it's going to get worse. So I get into all of this to try and get you to understand that political rhetoric is nice and good intentions are nice, but let's face facts, all right? President Trump has enabled a total rhino and failure of a House Speaker in Mike Johnson, who has been promoting, since he got into that job, Democrat priorities as much as or more than Republican ones. And that's simply how I see it. It's how a lot of other advocates of small government libertarianism see it as well. He has thrown away, when he's had an opportunity to legislate some of it, savings that Elon Musk and the Doge people have found. The same has been true in the Senate. And institutionally, this is the mess that we're in. And I don't really think President Trump can change it. And he certainly shows that it's more important to him once in a while to have everybody on board and loyal and not be insubordinate when he will cover for Mike Johnson and a horrible job of limiting spending, when at the same time he'll attack somebody like a Tom Massie, the Republican congressman from Kentucky, who's one of the only ones on Capitol Hill that actually believes Trump's own rhetoric, that we need to cut waste and fraud and abuse. We need to rein in the debt, if not pay some of it down. This is all fantasy. And look, we've all seen this movie before, at least if you're as old as I am or close to it, you've seen this movie before. We had the same promises, much the same themes, much the same lingo, much the same hysterical opposition from the Democrats way back 45 years ago when Ronald Reagan took office and when he unleashed, so we thought anyway, what was came to be called the Grace Commission. The fancy name was the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control. In current day dollars, that commission over a little bit more than a year's time came up with something like $7 trillion in today's dollars in savings. And virtually none of it was enacted. The Democrats still were hysterical about, you know, if a budget for a certain agency only went up 8%, was supposed to go up 10%, they would howl about, you know, the hacking and gouging and cutting of programs. You'd think you were watching an ad for one of the slasher movies from those years. But nothing got slashed. By the time Ronald Reagan left office, the annual deficit was five times higher than what he inherited from Jimmy Carter. And regrettably, we're at that same place again. And I don't fault Ronald Reagan per se. I don't think he used his own bully pulpit near enough. I don't think he completely understood just how entrenched this culture was in Washington. Donald Trump probably understands that aspect of things far more than Ronald Reagan did, as he should, because now things are that much worse after the last 45 or so years of the deep state being entrenched, of you know, the uniparty on Capitol Hill never wanting to cut spending, no matter who's got the gavels. But we're at a place where this rubber band just can't be stretched any further. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the markets react in the days ahead. Of course, I'll be talking about that and making whatever, offering whatever guidance is necessary to national investors as we see this unfold. But it's already pretty much understood that the Senate is going to make some changes, perhaps some substantial ones, as the president himself admitted over the weekend, to the one big beautiful bill that the House passed by one vote last week. Then it's going to have to go to a conference. We'll see if all of these cats can be herded to have, in the end, one big amended beautiful bill, or whatever the case may be. Regrettably, the likelihood is that there's going to be something bogged down to where this, and the Senate's leader, John Thune, already warned of this a while ago, that this is probably going to be broken up. If Trump wants his tax cuts, what is more likely than not to happen is that they're going to have to break out that part of the bill and vote on it alone, and then go back and tackle the spending things and some other things, maybe even immigration funding as part of that. That remains to be seen. But I continue to believe, and I'm going to add a couple of links as well from Citicorp's CEO, as well as from the soon-to-retire J.P. Morgan executive Jamie Dimon, some stuff he said, that when you look at the budget situation and how much of a mess it is, you look at this topsy-turvy tariff situation and how it's created uncertainty, and then not to mention all the stuff I've been discussing earlier on in this podcast, most of all the broader global landscape that is about to shift in much more seismic fashion than the bits and pieces we've seen in the last several years of these incremental moves away from globalization and toward a multipolar world. That's going to accelerate. It's going to get messier. When you look at all of these different things, it's why this, I think that the market is out over its skis and just doesn't grasp fully what is going on right now. That doesn't mean things are going to implode, at least for the time being, thanks to the Fed. and I say that tongue in cheek. There's still a lot of liquidity in markets, including in the U.S. market. But it's not, you know, strange that in the recent past, with the Treasury market being weaker, the Fed has even had to start some new backdoor quantitative easing, covering up some of the recent Treasury auctions when the auctions weren't going as well as thought. Now, that's going to just increase as time goes on. So I guess the old saying is, may you live in interesting times. That's an understatement right now. We're going to see some things that have already been trends for a while now accelerate. As I said, it's going to involve commodities. It's going to involve our way of life. It's going to involve security and a whole bunch of things. And I urge you to not go very far, just to stay close to yours truly. Follow these podcasts, follow the National Investor and the other things I put out, including from time to time with a lot of my colleagues that I work with. You know, this is all unprecedented, folks. There is not a model for what is coming. There are some suppositions we can make, but beyond that, you know, we have to figure this out as we go along. And as I say all the time, you can't do it with preconceived notions. You can't do it as a Republican or a Democrat, a right winger or a left winger. You need to have solid information and, of course, knowledge that I always stress. That's why I love that earlier interview of Professor Dyson's that I'm sending along to you. That's key to understand, as well as a lot of these other things. So thank you for your time and attention and tuning in this particular episode, and we'll be back with you before too much longer.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to Chris at nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.